Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Protests erupting across the Arab world now. First it was Tunisia, then Egypt, then now Libya, Bahrain, Yemen, Jordan, Morocco, Algeria, and more. Autocratic governments, many of them American allies, teetering under pressure and teetering all at once. So how should the U.S. respond to this hour on Point, the right now and the future of American foreign policy in a boiling Arab world? You can join the conversation. Are you thrilled and cheering, scared and confused? How should the United States respond to the uproar? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Michelle Dunn. She's Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, former Specialist on Middle East Affairs at the State Department and White House. Michelle Dunn, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for inviting me, Tom.
Also with us from Doha, Qatar, is Shadi Hamid, Director of Research at the Brookings Doha Center and Fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's been in Egypt and Jordan following the protests. Shadi, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And with us from New York is Leslie Gelb, President Emeritus and Senior Board Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's author of the book Power Rules, How Common Sense Can Rescue American Foreign Policy. Leslie Gelb, welcome back to On Point. Very good to have you.
Hi, Tom.
Let me go first to Shadi Hamid. Shadi, you're there in the region. What are you seeing unfold, and what does it mean for the posture America has had in this region now for decades?
Well, everything is changing, and for a long time, the U.S. depended on many of these regimes to advance its interests in the region, and that's no longer going to be the case anymore. None of these regimes are guaranteed. This is the end of the stability paradigm, and we are really seeing, I think, a pan-Arab democratic moment. There's no other way to describe this. There was a sense that maybe Tunisia was exceptional, but then we had Egypt. Two cases makes a pattern. We might have Libya being number three. We can't go back to the way the Arab world was before. I think that's the major takeaway here.
Is this promising for the United States and its interests, however you might define them? Is it threatening?
It's a mix of both. Here's the thing. Democracy is messy. It's uncertain. You can't predict who's going to win the next election. Up until now, for the last several decades, we always knew who would be in power. So that's definitely going to change. But we have to keep in mind the last 5 decades of bipartisan U.S. foreign policy proved to be a failure, and we're seeing the failure right now as we speak. The region is coming apart. It's falling apart, and that's because of misguided, short-sighted U.S. policy for a long time. We supported dictators, but we didn't care about the people on the ground and Arab popular aspirations. And sooner or later, that was going to come to hurt us, and that's what we're seeing now. And the list is long in terms of how things have gone wrong, but the rise of extremism and terrorism leading up to 9/11, I mean, this is not a stable region. So it's kind of ironic that a policy that was meant to guarantee stability brought about the opposite.
Leslie Gelb in New York, how do you see what's happening right now? And are we witnessing a 5-decade failure of American foreign policy unfolding?
Well, we're certainly witnessing revolutionary change. And, you know, the people are going to do what the people are going to do at this point, and armies will do what they'll do. We don't know. And whether that's a failure of U.S. foreign policy, I really can't say that. Look, it's a fact that administrations for 30 or 40 years, did try to push these very regimes toward reform. We did. And they resisted. And if we tried to push harder, we were afraid that we'd jeopardize our strategic interests. And for 30, 40 years, our policy was protecting our strategic interests. At some point, this was all going to come a cropper. And that happens to be now. Whether that's a failure of U.S. foreign policy, I don't know. Foreign policy generalists like myself supported that approach. I didn't hear much opposition or predictions of calamity from the area experts. Right now, they're talking about as if they had been saying this would happen for 30 years themselves. but I only hear it in the last few weeks from them.
So can U.S. strategic interests coexist with this wave that we see crossing the Arab world, or is this a threat to those interests? Is it perhaps even a better foundation for relations if these are democracies instead of dictatorships?
There's some hope if they're real democracies, because I think those kinds of regimes will be attracted to us. We are a democracy. But I think it's more threat than opportunity at this point.
And why?
Because I think it's more likely that extremist elements will take control. And these extremist elements are anti-American because they see us as supporters of the regimes that oppress them. They see us as the country that invaded fellow Muslim states like Iraq and Afghanistan, and as supporters of Israel. So these are very strong emotions, and I think they will come to the fore in any democratic movement.
Michelle Dunn, do you see extremist elements inevitably or likely coming to the fore in democratic movements? We're seeing this, the stirrings of so many right now.
Not necessarily. First of all, we've got to differentiate one country from another.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's going to happen in a place like Egypt, for example, where you have political parties, you have an active civil society, even an independent media, you've got some institutions that enjoy some credibility, like the judiciary, is very different from a place like Libya, where should the Gaddafi regime fall, we really have no idea what would come in its place, because it's a place without institutions and so forth. But I also want to take issue with something that Les Gelb said, that mm-hmm. the United States had been trying to push for reforms for 30 or 40 years. I really don't think that's true. There were some very timid attempts in the 1990s and a few more during the administration of George W. Bush, say from 2002 to 2005, to press for reforms. But in the main, the whole idea of reform, that we would really be working with governments that we were allied with and that we were giving assistance with to press them to carry out political reforms, has really not been the case. We did a little bit more on economic reform, but we really never made political reform a serious priority except for a very short time during the Bush administration.
And so Les Gelb says that's because administrations were afraid if they pushed too hard, the stability paradigm maybe would be gone and the United States would be in trouble. So now it's gone, says Shadi Hamid. So are we in trouble with this, Michelle, or are we in a better place?
Well, I think we're having to dance pretty fast mm-hmm. to catch up with realities here. And I think we see the U.S. administration struggling a bit to show that, well, yes, it was on the side of democracy and human rights and so forth all along. Look, I agree that, you know, in the long run, if some of these countries become democracies, the United States could have stable, more mature relationships, as it has, for example, with Israel or with Turkey, other countries in the region that are democracies. But I also agree with Shadi that there's a rough road between here and there. And, it's not going to be transitions to democracy, even when they go well, are often not smooth.
Shadi Hamid, we will look at the individual countries here. They're very important distinctions. But if this is a wave, if we're going to be facing the end of what you call the stability paradigm, does the United States need to or will it be forced to reconsider its strategic interests in this region?
Well, at this point, the U.S. doesn't really have a choice. The region is changing. It won't go back to the way it was. So there will be emerging democracies in the region. So we have to make a choice now. Do we want to fundamentally realign U.S. policy to adapt to that new reality? Or do we want to hold on to the vestiges of an old system? It's not, to be fair, it's not an easy choice because there will be difficulties in the road ahead. And as Mr. Gelb suggested, there are concerns about how these new governments would deal with Israel, the peace treaty, Iran, and so on. These new governments are going to adopt a more independent foreign policy, something akin to maybe Turkey right now. Some people like the Turkish model, some people don't. But as Michelle said, we're going to have to evolve towards a more mature approach to dealing with this. And we really have a chance to regain credibility in the eyes of Arabs. If Arabs see us as partners in this change, that we're unequivocally supporting their democratic aspirations, that is going to change the whole relationship that we have. Because up until now, Arabs have blamed us for many things, but one of the most important is that they saw us as backing their oppressors, not for a couple years, but for a couple decades at least. And now we have a chance to change that. So there is opportunity in crisis.
Is that fundamental realignment as simple as embracing whatever regimes come out of this period of turmoil, or something bigger, Shadi?
We certainly have to embrace the democratic governments that emerge. But let's keep in mind, we're not at that place right now. There are countries that are in a difficult middle area where you have protesters and governments at a stalemate. So that includes Yemen, Bahrain, Libya, Morocco. There's still a very long list of countries that aren't quite there yet. So the question is, what do we want to do here? And I think we have to have stronger rhetoric. And instead of being behind the curve and reacting to events, we have to be in a position to shape them, to influence them, and to put more pressure on these governments. It's not just about rhetoric, but it's about how do we translate rhetoric into tangible policy on the ground. The good thing is that the U.S. does have considerable leverage with many of these regimes, certainly with a regime like Bahrain and Morocco. Morocco receives...
Shadi Hamid, hold it there in Doha, if you'd be kind enough. Leslie Gelb in New York, Michelle Dunn in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Doctors chanting there in a protest march yesterday in Bahrain. We are talking this hour about American foreign policy across the Arab world as the Arab world boils. Leslie Gelb is with us, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, former Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for the New York Times. Michelle Dunn is here, Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace from Washington. And in Doha, Qatar, Shadi Hamid, Director of Research at the Brookings Doha Center, joins us as well. He's been in Egypt, in Jordan. Leslie Gelb, Shadi Hamid says we may need a fundamental realignment here. What would that look like? And can we have that without a change in our sort of strategic interest understanding?
Well, at this point, I don't know what we do, because both Shadid and Ms. Dunn were talking about the new realities out there. I don't know what these new realities are. What we see is revolutionary change. Mm-hmm. Where this is going to end up, they don't know any better than I do. None of these experts, as I said, were predicting mm-hmm. this revolutionary holocaust. And now the situation is all in turmoil, and we don't know where it will land. Take Egypt, for example. Egypt could move toward a much more serious Turkish-style democracy, or it could end up with a military dictatorship, de facto or de jure. That is, by being mm-hmm. voted into power.
Yep.
In the case of Bahrain, a very important ally that keeps a naval base for us, the royal family there could be thrown out, or that somehow they could hang on. I'm not going to get into the business of predicting, because I don't know. When it settles down, there's no question but the people, whatever that means, you know, could mean religious extremists, Democrats, the whole package. Mm-hmm. They might pull in an anti-American direction or in a more neutral direction. We just don't know. And we can't be so smart mm-hmm. as to make a new policy today.
Michelle, what's your sense of how this might unfold? I mean, do you see an inevitable wave here? Are we going to end up with a checkerboard? Some who have gone through a revolutionary process come out on the other side, others crushed and turned back. What does that look like, Michelle?
Well, look, we're already going to have a checkerboard, because already in a region that had pretty much all authoritarian regimes, with the exception of Israel and Turkey, we now, you know, have an evolving democratic government in Iraq, for a totally different reason, of course, but then now states that are moving toward democracy in, at a minimum, Egypt and Tunisia. And we'll see where these other states go. I wanted to say something, though, about U.S. interests. Mm-hmm. The interest that the United States has pursued for decades, you know, since the Second World War, a little before, when the United States became active in the Middle East, have been getting petroleum out of the region, which is essential not for the United States only, but for the world economy, the security of the state of Israel. And recently, of course, counterterrorism has become one of our main interests. Mm-hmm. Before, in decades before, it was the Cold War and keeping Soviet Soviet influence out of the Middle East. Now, we really are going to have to add to that the promotion of democratic government and human rights. And one might say, well, it's a contradiction. How can we can't do all these things at the same time? But I'd like to point out that there have always been contradictions built into U.S. interests in the Middle East. Protecting the security of Israel and getting the cooperation of Arab governments, for example, on getting oil out of the region and so forth, has always been something in the United States has had to balance. So we're going to have to balance interests that rub up against each other. We're just going to have to add this new one.
Shadi Hamid, you spoke of a fundamental realignment of U.S. policy in the region. If that's necessary, if that's what we've come to, what would that look like? And will it have to have some old and some new in it? Because we may have old, you know, non-overthrown regimes who have cracked down and new governments with a very different kind of public support behind them. What would that realignment look like, Shadi?
Well, as I was saying earlier, there are ways for us to go beyond just rhetoric and to actually change our policy on the ground in the coming months, and those are months that will be crucial. And we have aid packages at our disposal. The U.S. gives considerable assistance to Egypt, Jordan, Morocco, and other countries. There's a strong relationship between the U.S. and militaries in the GCC countries, for example. So there are points of leverage that we can use, and that's especially relevant in a case like Bahrain, where, you know, just up until a day or two ago, there was a real possibility of massacres in broad daylight. So I think we have to start pushing on those pressure points. More generally, this might be a time for a grand strategy speech that Obama can deliver to really explain to the world how the U.S. is thinking about these changes and how it plans to adapt to them. I think the problem here is that the U.S. is still dealing with things as business as usual. There hasn't been any kind of new shift, really. But the gravity of the events on the ground today require bold, creative policymaking. And we can talk about what creative policymaking looks like, but I think that the U.S., at least at a starting point, has to define more clearly to the world what it wants from this period and display a new commitment to democratic change in the region. I think that would go a long way in encouraging the reform movements that we're seeing, putting pressure on dictators to move faster and regain U.S. credibility in the region and the world at large.
Let's go. Can the U.S. have a single grand strategy here that hangs together right now? I mean, Michelle talked about it being a mixed bag. Can we have, as fundamental strategic interests, oil for the U.S. and the world is backing Israel, counterterrorism, and the cultivation of democracy? Does that fit into one big bag?
Well, that's been our bag all along. The democracy element, as I said, is something we did raise with our allies for 30, 40 years.
Yes, but not in a way that made them really change. That's been changed in the streets.
Uh-huh. Because in the way we added up our interests, the strategic ones way outweighed that ones. And today, if you ask people who make foreign policy, they would still reckon it more or less the same way. They don't know where this democracy movement is going. How can we have a new grand strategy that Obama is going to disgorge himself of in a speech tomorrow when we don't understand the new realities, we don't begin to understand them, or where this revolutionary movement is going to land? I would say if we did that, if Obama got up and gave a speech tomorrow, he'd change it on Saturday, and then he'd change it 2 weeks from then. We don't know as the situation unfolds. And we can't even begin to predict what's going on there. Which of these Middle East experts, was saying Libya would come apart 2 weeks ago, or a month ago when Egypt started, that Bahrain would do it. They didn't say it, and we don't know.
Could Arab democracy, widely practiced, be compatible with the other interests on this old or existing U.S. strategic interest list? Oil, Israel, counterterrorism.
We're going to have to make it, try to make it somewhat compatible, whether we like it or not, because they live there, and we're not going to be able to unseat them or undo them. We can shape their interests at the margins with our military contacts, with our aid, but it's only at the margins. These aren't going to be great opportunities for the United States to help them convert themselves into Turkish-style or Egyptian, new Egyptian-style democracy. We don't know what it is.
And right now, when so much is in flux, where should the U.S. be throwing its weight, its support, toward change or toward its old allies, Leskell?
Well, I think we've got to make clear, rhetorically, as the administration has, that it wants to be on the right side of history, that it's in favor of free protest, the free assembly, free speech, democracy, and it said all those things. But it can't simply walk away from its allies because we do have these other strategic interests to protect. The Saudis are looking at every little move we make, or the King of Jordan, mm-hmm. And the others, and we need them. And if we were simply to, quote, side with the people, whatever that means, they would adjust their foreign policies accordingly.
Michelle, we have been walking away to this point. We certainly walked away from Hosni Mubarak. What about Bahrain? Just take that one. The Saudis are looking across this 15-mile causeway at this, small entity right there on their borders with a big Shiite population. Do you think Saudi Arabia will let a people's power revolution succeed in Bahrain, Michelle?
Well, that's a big question, and that, you know, there is this causeway between Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, and, apparently the purpose of it is to allow Saudi Arabia to intervene militarily in Bahrain if necessary. But, look, political reform is long overdue in Bahrain. And this is something that the United States should have been promoting. And by the way, there are a number of Middle East experts who've been writing that for a number of years, that the United States should be using its relationship, close relationship with the Bahraini government to, you know, try to persuade that government to carry out real political reform. We're now, you know, at the 11th hour. I hope there's still time for that. But, you know, what the Bahraini opposition has been pressing for is moving toward a constitutional monarchy in Bahrain and giving the elected parliament some real power. That's something that King Hamad sort of hinted at a decade ago, didn't come through on. And then, you know, recently they've been carrying out some very, very repressive measures in Bahrain, arresting much of the opposition, human rights groups, accusing them of involvement in terrorism, and extending nationality to a lot of non-Bahraini Sunni Muslims to try to tip the demographic balance in the country, because it's 70% Shia Muslim population with a Sunni Muslim ruling family, and that creates a lot of tension. So, really, I think that U.S. officials have been kind of blind and deaf to what was going on inside of Bahrain, to tension that was building, and U.S. officials have been far too generous in their public comments to the Bahraini leader. And now we see ourselves caught flat-footed by this.
And it's in the streets. Michelle Dunn, Leslie Gelb, Shadi Hamid, please stand by. Let's get our callers in here. Columbia, South Carolina, Matthew's calling. Hi, Matthew, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Dom. Yeah, you know, I just have to agree with Michelle and Shamid. These popular democratic movements, I mean, you just can't. They need to be supported. They need to be, even if in the initial setup after the dust has settled, that there are, democratic regimes that are unhappy with, unfriendly towards the United States, give them a decade or so. Let these internal struggles take place to let folks figure out whether they're going to be a more secular society or a more religious society. Let these countries determine what they want to be, and if the United States move to the side and support you know, the fundamental human rights of letting people decide for themselves.
Matthew, I understand exactly the points of principle you're standing on. Do you think that could leave the U.S., I don't know, without oil, without with ally Israel in trouble? How do you factor those pieces in?
We can support Israel in whatever ways we need to support Israel. When it comes to the whole oil issue, well, heck, we've been trying to get off of oil for years. Isn't it time to just go ahead and do something about it? I know that's a little pie in the sky and a little flip, but, you know, a majority of our oil comes from Canada anyway. You know, what's the biggest issue if we have to pay a little bit more in the pump? Sure, that'll cause some unrest here, but we can afford to pay a little bit more, I'd imagine. I mean, we get a lot of things subsidized.
Matthew, I appreciate your call very much. Michelle Dunn, a little more at the pump. I mean, if things really get hairy out there, Saudi Arabia remains, you know, the biggest ocean of oil on the planet. You know, what are the stakes in terms of resources, let's say?
Well, some of the big questions here, right, there's Saudi Arabia with its massive reserves. Libya is also a question for, you know, for Europe particularly, is gets a lot of its oil from Libya. The other question is oil being able to move out of the region through these strategic choke points through which oil is shipped. So, you know, there are some very serious questions there. I don't think we're looking at a situation, for example, in which Saudi Arabia would be very angry about a change in Bahrain and deliberately cut off oil to the world or something like that. That would be cutting off their own nose to spite their face. But if we were looking at instability in Saudi Arabia, that could lead to a situation where we have serious spikes in the price of oil. But right now, Saudi Arabia is quiet.
For now, Jenny in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Jenny, you're on the air.
Hi there. I'm calling because we hear endless discussion of our interests in the Mideast. And as an American and mm-hmm. as someone who is witnessing some pretty horrendous conditions here at home, government efforts to bust legitimate unions and so many people unemployed,
okay.
pollution, et cetera, it seems to me that when you use the word our, you need to distinguish between the needs at home and the interests of a corporate-backed government that wants to control Mideast oil. That, I think, has been going on since probably before the Second World War and has a lot to do with the American support for Israel and for the brutal occupation.
You know, an awful lot of American
people.
Governments have said the whole national economy needs access to that oil. Are you now saying no?
Between your kind of sports narration of this whole thing mm-hmm. to do with American economic power being exerted and military weapons being sold to these various dictatorships, could you make a distinction mm-hmm. between the needs of the American people and the needs of your corporations?
Jenny, I appreciate your call. Les Gelb, can you follow a line between those two?
Well, in this case, I hate to see the corporations taking such big profits, and I certainly don't want to go to war to protect their interests. But as you said to the caller, we need the oil, not just the corporations, America.
And yet you hear from the American side there's a real sort of alternate view or second view of the whole region, a willingness to say maybe not.
Yeah, well, they can say maybe not, but they will be crying if things go south on us. And right now, I think they are going south.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking to Sarah about American foreign policy across the Arab world as the Arab world boils. We've all seen it over the weekend. One country after another, from Morocco and Algeria and Libya, right on across to Bahrain on the Persian Gulf. Lots of Arab world in the streets. Machine guns in response in some places. Sort of a toing and froing. Washington looking to find a new posture as this region changes. We're asking, what should the center of American foreign policy be as this Arab world rises up? Leslie Gelb is with us, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. Michelle Dunn is with us from the Carnegie Endowment on International Peace. And Shadi Hamid with us from Doha, Director of the research at the Brookings Doha Center there. Let's get a call from Esla in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Esla, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I am originally from Egypt. Mm-hmm. And here is a novel idea. How about America treat the people in the Middle East with respect as human beings with hopes and aspirations? Would they really want to sell the oil? They're not going to drink it. So if we have an equal relationship with respect, it will be fine. These people should have democracy. It's long overdue.
And many in this country have cheered as they've seen it unfold in Tahrir Square. Esla, I appreciate your call. Shadi, so many Americans have responded to exactly that. At the same time, Leslie Gelb says he sees our overall position going south. How do you see the overall U.S. position as this thing unfolds?
So I think some of the alarmism about the U.S. losing the Arab world and some of these new governments being anti-American is exaggerated. There may be some truth to it, but I think it's overblown. So, for example, there are no extremist elements that are going to take over these governments. I'm not sure what these extremist groups are, who they are. Perhaps that's a reference to the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the largest opposition force in Egypt, but I don't think very few people see the Brotherhood as an extremist organization these days. Yes, they're quite conservative. Yes, they don't like Israel. That's all true, but to be fair, most Egyptians don't like Israel, and most Egyptians want to see Islam play a larger role in public life. So in that sense, groups like the Muslim Brotherhood are firmly in the mainstream of Arab society. That said, we have to think about this. What happens if the Brotherhood comes to power in groups like that? And I think there are actions the U.S. can take now to mitigate some of those concerns. One way to do that would be to engage with the Brotherhood sooner rather than later, so we can put some pressure on them, have some leverage, and try to tell them what matters to us as Americans, and there can be an exchange of ideas and an exchange of interests. But I don't think any future Egyptian government is going to want to get rid of the peace treaty with Israel. Why would a new government want to be on the international community's blacklist right from the get-go? I just don't see why that would happen. Also, $1.5 billion of U.S. aid to Egypt are on the line as well.
Michelle Dunn, do you share that confidence? Shadi says no extremist groups are going to take over these governments. There's a lot of countries and a lot of governments. Do you share that confidence?
I think we need to look at each country individually, okay, because, yeah, I can't make a general point like that for all of them. I'm not fearful about extremists taking control in Tunisia, for example. Regarding Egypt, I'm not very fearful of it there either, and I'll tell you why. While the Muslim Brotherhood has a lot of positions that I don't approve of and I don't like, I don't think they're going to take over. The Muslim Brotherhood has been playing politics in Egypt for decades now, and they've shown a lot of self-restraint, and I think they're going to continue to do that. They've already, first of all, I certainly don't see them mounting a coup of some kind. There's nothing going on in the Muslim Brotherhood that tells me that they are positioning themselves for that. The Muslim Brotherhood has already announced that they're not going to be running for the presidency, which is very important in Egypt. I mean, the only, if we're talking about a Muslim Brotherhood takeover, the only realistic scenario I see is if they could gain two-thirds of the seats in the Egyptian parliament, then they could have enough votes to revise the constitution. I don't think that's very likely either, but they are an important force in Egyptian political life, and I think we need to be realistic. Shadi is basically correct that many of their positions, not all of them, many of their positions are widely held by the Egyptian public, and whatever new Egyptian government we see is going to be more responsive to Egyptian public opinion than the Mubarak government was. I also agree, I don't think that's going to mean abrogation of the peace treaty with Israel. It's probably going to mean more criticism of Israel, however, by the Egyptian government.
What about yes, Leslie, please. Let's go.
Yeah, because a lot has been said that I mostly disagree with. Obviously, you have to look at this state by state. That goes without saying. Mm-hmm. But what is democracy going to mean there? We have some examples of democracy. The Bush administration pushed for democracy in the Gaza Strip. And what did we get? One vote, one time, one dictatorship, Hamas. They pushed Syria out of Lebanon. That was good. And Hezbollah came to power. Now, I wouldn't want Hezbollah as my neighbor. And we engaged in a 10-year war to promote democracy in Iraq. And we're doing something similar in Afghanistan. Now, are they showing signs of being great democracies? I wish well for the people of Iraq, but we don't know and they don't know at this point. And our Middle East experts don't know at this point. Democracy can take all sorts of turns. And there aren't many political parties in these countries that are organized to support, really, pluralistic democracies. The best organized are the religious parties. Now, the religious parties, particularly in Egypt, have put their heads down, and they promise peace and democracy, and maybe so. I wish that so. But I would bet they're just lying low, and as the others begin to falter, we'll see the religious extremism come out.
But what's the implication of what you say?
Let me make one more point. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I don't think there's a great deal we can do about it. Mm-hmm. And that's why the calls for a new grand strategy or whatever don't make much sense to me. Michelle said earlier, we should try to persuade the Bahrainis. Well, there's modest gruel for you. I would try to persuade them, too. Let's have peaceful change. We tried to persuade Mubarak to do that.
Mm-hmm. But what's the alternative? Once people are in the streets less, Gelb, and sort of rising up and claiming their civil society or trying to, you can't say go back under the dictator, can you?
No, we can't. We can't. We're absolutely caught flat out at this point. And there are some regimes I think it's important for us to try to make clear we support, like Jordan, like Saudi Arabia. Do I like them? Do I think they're democratic or Kuwait? No. But they do represent our strategic interest in the area. Should we try to persuade them on democratic reform? Sure, let's try to persuade them. I'm all for it.
What about the one-time, one-vote, one-dictatorship formula, Michelle, that Leslie Gelb puts worryingly for him and others on the table?
Right. Well, first of all, let me say something about trying to persuade, because I don't think we seriously tried to persuade President Mubarak in Egypt to carry out reforms. Okay, for example, what the current U.S. administration has been doing is just, you know, raising these issues. There's a difference between, for example, raising with the Egyptian government, we think you should lift the state of emergency, say it privately, say it publicly. That's raising these issues and really trying. In other words, having a strategy in place where you're willing to put something on the table.
But that's history now. Mubarak's gone, right?
Okay, but if we're talking about mm-hmm. Bahrain, mm-hmm. if we're talking about Jordan, if we're talking about Morocco, these are countries that the United States has, as Shadi indicated, significant relationships with, military relationships and relationships of assistance, where we have some leverage there. And we need to think strategically about, you know, really how we can use these relationships in a serious way to persuade them to undertake reforms before it's too late. And that doesn't mean just, you know, raising it once in a while, as we have been doing.
Shadi Hamid, in Doha, are we already well down that road? I mean, at this point, does it matter what the United States does? Can the United States determine outcomes now, here in Morocco, in Bahrain, in Jordan, in Yemen, or is it beyond U.S. influence?
Well, the outcomes are still very much in question, so there is certainly a role for the international community to play. And we don't really know what's going to happen in Yemen. We don't know what's going to happen in Bahrain, and the list goes on. So we can't guarantee that we're going to be able to push the outcome in one direction or the other. My main point is that we try. We make a good faith effort to be more serious about democracy promotion at this critical juncture. Yes, it is risky, but most good things are risky. And the question is there the political will on the part of the Obama administration to experiment a little bit, to be creative, to try something new, and to use our leverage, and to say to regimes, listen, if you're going to shoot on your protesters one more time, then your aid package might be cut down, and cut down in a very serious way. I haven't heard that yet from the Obama administration.
What do you think all this is going to mean, Shadi, for Israel? We've seen Egypt, the new military government in Egypt, allowing Iranian naval ships through the Suez Canal for the first time since the Iranian Revolution in 1979. Of course, coming up through the Suez, that will put them right near Israel when they come out the mouth of that canal. How does Israel live with all this change, Shadi?
To be fair, Israel does have reason to be concerned. The future governments of the region are going to be less amenable to Israeli interests. That is true. That said, as I said before, they shouldn't be worrying about an abrogation of the peace treaty. What this might do is put more pressure on Israel to get serious on the peace process. That could be one of the interesting side benefits of all of this, because if Israel is in fact worried that these anti-Israel regimes are emerging, then now is the time to make peace before they become more powerful. And in some ways, democracy and the Arab-Israeli conflict are tied together. Democratically elected governments are going to be less anti-Israel if there is a peace treaty. If there isn't a peace treaty, they will continue, as is the case with most Arab people, to be anti-Israel. So there is a connection there, and I think we have to look at interesting ways of connecting the two and seeing how we can make progress on both fronts.
Tom, come.
Yes,
I
please.
Address that?
Yes, please.
Look, I'm against the Israeli settlements, and I'm strongly against them, and have always been. And I think the negotiating position of the present Israeli government is wrong. But if you go back to previous negotiations over the last 10 years, the Israelis put proposals on the table that went 95-97% of the way toward the Palestinian position.
But we saw in the WikiLeaks Palestinians also trying kind
of... Yeah, they did respond, but the point is the Israelis did put those positions on the table. And the Palestinians came back with something, but not as a formal, any kind of formal offer.
What about now in this new turmoil, in this new fluidity? What about now, Leskov? How do you see how do you see Israel, U.S. ally, Israel's policy profile changing in response to all this turmoil and fluidity?
They haven't got much room for change at all. They've got to do what we do, namely accept it and keep a watchful eye out for dangerous change. But, you know, the notion that there's a role for the international community, that we should now start threatening these regimes with aid cut off, these are steps several miles too far for what we understand now. We don't even know what these democracy movements are about.
But can we afford to sit, if they're shooting the people in the streets,
we're against that, and we've said we're against it. And we're trying very hard in private through the military channels to stop it. We are. And by and large, I think we've been successful in most places. And we did make an effort to get Mubarak out of power. Privately, we told him, hey, you begin this transition, you begin it now, turn over power to somebody else, don't run for re-election. Now, by the time he said it, it was too late because every day the demands on the streets rose. But it's not as if we weren't trying to help the democracy movement, even though we were worried about what it really meant.
Let me get a call from Karam in Boston. Karam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for receiving my call, sir.
Yes. Yes.
I just have a quick opinion about democracy. Was that we cannot impose democracy on people as it happened with Iraq. We cannot impose that. And I would say just leave the people do and determine whatever they want to do and whatever the decision is, and just to stay out of it. It's their destiny. It's their life. I think that's my opinion.
Haram, I appreciate your call. Michelle Dunn, where do you see this going?
Well, look, I think one of the most interesting things that has happened since the Tunisian uprising started in the middle of December is that we've seen that there was a great deal of pent-up demand for change and pent-up demand for democracy. People were saying for years, oh, the West is trying to force democracy on peoples in the Middle East who don't want it and so forth. And those of us who watch the region carefully were saying, no, we actually think, I mean, polling data and the information that exists shows there is a lot of demand for democracy in the region. I mean, Les Gelb said, we don't know what these democratic movements are about. But I don't think that's true, with the exception maybe of Libya, which is a very, very opaque situation. Mm-hmm. But in these other countries, these movements, these demands for change have been around. And there's a thread running through all these demands, which is this, that in almost every Arab country, most of the political power is concentrated in the hands of one person, whether it's a monarch or a president, and that person is not freely chosen, is not freely elected, is not accountable via the ballot box. That's the main issue, and also that they've been staying in power for not years, but decades. That is the main issue that people are protesting against. So I don't think this is an issue at all of the West now trying to impose democracy on the region. We are seeing the demands for democracy boil up from the streets, and it's a question of how we can respond.
A question that's going to stand there for some time now as the U.S. accustoms itself to the unfolding, amazing new reality across this Arab world. Michelle Dunn with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thank you very much for your insights and thoughts today, Michelle.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Shadi Hamid in Doha with the Brookings Doha Center there. Thank you very much for joining us, Shadi.
Thank you for having me.
And Leslie Gelb, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, joining us from New York, author of Power Rules. Les Gelb, thank you very much for being with us
Always
today.
Always a pleasure.
We will be watching. What a scene across this huge region. Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.